Welcome to Remembering 9/11, special production of Perspectives from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm editor Mark Troutwine. September 11, 2001. Four jetliners hijacked by 19 terrorists. Two flown into the World Trade Center Twin Towers, one into the Pentagon. The fourth, probably headed for the White House or the Capitol, crashed when passengers defied their captors. Almost 3,000 died. The chain of events that followed stretches to this day, 10 years later. They have touched and continue to touch many people in many ways. We asked KQED listeners to send us their perspective on 9/11 and its aftermath, and in this half hour we'll hear from nine of them. Collectively, their perspectives tell a story of how we experienced attack and horror, how we responded to the consequences, and how we've come to terms with what's happened. It's not the only 9/11 narrative that could or should be told, but it is one our listeners want to tell. These days, news is routinely labeled shocking. It almost never is. But September 11, 2001 was shocking. Our "what you were doing when" moment appalled in a new, disorienting way. Many were traumatized. Some say the nation was traumatized. American wars have spared us hell in our backyards. So the emotions 9/11 evoked were primal and raw. For many, they remain primal and raw today, even after 10 years of reflection, 10 years to come to terms with what each of us, in our own way, experienced that day. For Amanda Eniety, the experience couldn't have been more shocking. A columnist and blogger now living in the Bay Area, she lived in Lower Manhattan on 9/11, blocks from the World Trade Center. She heard the first plane hit the North Tower. She saw the second plane hit the South Tower. And for her and her family, it was time to flee or fight.
After I stood among my fellow New Yorkers on 6th and Bleecker on the morning of September 11th, 2001, stunned as we watched the towers crumble, I stuffed what I could into my tiny car and drove off the island of Manhattan, intending to escape to Canada. My husband and I drove past the long line waiting to give blood at St. Vincent's. His instinct was to stop to see what we could do to help. Mine was to get out. "They're coming," I kept saying. "They'll be here soon." The nation was told that Manhattan was on lockdown, but that wasn't in fact true. We drove straight north on Henry Hudson Parkway, right past the open, unmanned toll booths. We made it as far as Peekskill, an hour out, at which point my husband prevailed and we stopped to spend the night. The shell-shocked innkeepers said nothing about our dogs. I sat frozen on a chair outside, looking out over green hills, watching the sun go down. And I replayed, again and again, the scenes of my escape from Iran 2 decades earlier. The burning buildings, the chanting on rooftops in the dark of night. A part of me always resented the ones who got to stay after the revolution. I was a child. I never had the choice to remain. My husband insisted we return to New York City. There was important work to be done, he said, and so we turned around the following day. Manhattan was blocked below 14th Street. We parked there and walked home. Every light pole, every wall, covered with flyers asking if you'd seen the missing. Everything and everyone looked gritty, as if we were extras dressed up as survivors of war, wandering around a bleak movie set. The air was chalky. Some wore surgical masks. We were breathing pulverized buildings and people for weeks. It was in those dark days that I finally understood that regardless of whether we stayed or left Iran, every last one of us was exiled. From our land, our culture, our touchstones of reality. At home and abroad, the wicked stole all of our birthrights, and they stole it in the name of God. But this time I remained, to stand my ground, to claim my homeland as mine. With a perspective, I'm Amanda Eniety.
Amanda Eniety chose to stay and fight. Others made her choice that day. But not all stood near where planes and buildings fell. But if September 11th was unlike any other day, it also was just like any other day. Workers went about their business, weddings were performed, school bells rang. Life and death struggles were waged not just in New York and Washington and the skies above Pennsylvania, but on streets and in hospitals across America. Those struggles were deeply personal, too. And for those that fought them, the larger events of 9/11 were just the background, the context, for what the numbers 9/11 will always mean to them. Adam Bardi is now a director at UCF Medical Center, living in San Mateo. while the rest of the country dealt with terror on home soil, his family fought a terrifying personal battle, inseparable from his experience of 9/11.
On September 11th, 2001, our son almost died. He was nowhere near New York City nor any of the other tragic events that dominated that fateful day. Benjamin was born, full term, and healthy on the 6th of September, but complications during delivery left him unable to breathe on his own. His condition quickly deteriorated, and in the last-ditch effort to save his life, he was transferred to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. After he was stabilized, my wife and I slept for a few hours and returned to the unit around 8 a.m., eager to see our little baby, completely oblivious to the chaos engulfing our country. We arrived to find nurses and staff gathered around a tiny, lone TV in the cramped waiting room, talking about an attack at the World Trade Center. We heard none of it, really. We had but one purpose, to find our baby. The morning progressed. Our son's condition again declined. News of suffering, heroism, confusion, and loss echoed in the hallways. With Benjamin's life dangling by a thread, it seemed that the world, our world, was Armageddon. This was our first child. We did not and could not comprehend that we had created a life, a precious little boy who was fighting to stay alive amid a world suddenly plunged into a black cloud of chaos, hatred, destruction, and death. Many lost loved ones that fateful day. We did not. Benjamin overcame the odds, and with the remarkable science, artistry, and compassion of his clinical team, he survived. He survived because we refused to accept another outcome. He began September 11th as the most critical patient on the entire unit and left 6 weeks later a healthy baby. For my family, our memories of that day are framed by profound contradiction. Benjamin blossomed into a beautiful and happy boy, later joined by a vibrant little brother, while thousands of other families who also suffered that day only have memories of their lost loved ones. These divergent outcomes have left us grateful, but disconnected from a significant turning point in American history. With a perspective, I'm Adam Barty.
History's advantage is that it knows what comes next, how one thing led to another. Who learned what they did next, and why, how the arc of human events changed, are connected. Consequences are known, measured. But when we live history in real time, we know none of this. 2 weeks after September 11th, KQED aired a perspective by a young Berkeley graduate named Jessie Hempel. She recognized that moment, soon after the terror attacks, but before everything that was to come, as an especially pregnant moment when individually and collectively we had choices about who we are and what we want to be. What kind of history would we write? Now a senior writer at Fortune magazine in New York, Jessie Hempel called this the moment between. And this is her perspective, originally aired September 25th, 2001.
I'm 26 years old. My generation has often been criticized as either cynical or apathetic. In truth, I've never felt the connection between the threat of foreign aggression and the safety of my community. I was born after Vietnam. The Gulf War felt like a distant social studies lesson. I've enjoyed the spoils of globalization, traveling freely throughout the world, and I entered the workforce during the strongest economy in decades. In the face of our nation's tragedy and suffering, who am I to have an epiphany? I hold instead to the meaning that comes from smaller observations. Recently, I've been thinking of the moments between events, moments when we have the power to act, even if these actions lead to our own demise. Between the terrorist attack and the World Trade Center collapse, firefighters rushed into the disaster. Between the hijackers' violent takeover and the actual explosion, passengers dialed loved ones to report the hijack. The beauty in these moments is that we don't know what comes next, and we have hope. That hope leads to action. We're in the midst of recovering from tragedy, but we're also in this weighted moment before. Before our response, before our retaliation, before the unknown. We mustn't get lost in feelings of powerlessness. Had passengers on United Flight 93 understood themselves as powerless, we might have no White House. Americans may never feel safe again, but I believe my generation has lost only the privilege of our ignorance, which isn't privilege at all. It is a time to risk complacency and take action in the spirit of hope. Read, educate ourselves, connect to our communities, Right. Patron the businesses of Muslim Americans. Call Congress. Call our moms, our families. Express our desire for peace or for war. Believe that each action we take, no matter how small, changes the future. This is the time to believe in the power of our voices and our vote, and to create connections that defy cynicism and apathy. With The Perspective, I'm Jesse Hempel.
In that moment between, something exhilarating happened. Americans embraced each other. Flags flew everywhere, not as symbols for political advantage, but banners of common purpose and shared values. We'd endured a monumentally divisive presidential election. The Supreme Court chose the winner for the first time in our history. But our first choice after 9/11 was higher ground. We had powerful symbols, examples living and martyred to emulate. The passengers on Flight 93, the first responders at the Pentagon, and especially, supremely, the firefighters of New York City. Their courage and sacrifice, so simple and good, lived not just in them as individuals, but collectively in them as family. That's how we thought of them, as family, and that's the kind of family we wanted to be. Rich Collins is a fire captain in the North Bay, and to him, family is what defines firefighters. Not only on iconic days like 9/11, but every single day.
10 years ago, I watched the news as the Twin Towers fell. I wrote this then, and it holds true for me today. People have asked countless times how I as a firefighter feel about September 11th. I tell them we as firefighters feel a great loss, because we are a family. In my job, you spend more time with your coworkers than you do with your wife and children, and we run into buildings just when everyone else wants to leave. I can't explain why. It's just what we do. It's who we are, and together we are a family. At the fire station, we eat together, we sleep in the same dormitory, we work together, cleaning, training, inspecting, and when we respond to emergencies, we are there side by side. Sometimes we help as life enters this world. More often, we try to keep it from departing. Whatever we do together, and together we are a family. I tell my daughters that if they are far from home, lost or in trouble, stop at the nearest fire station and tell them your father's a firefighter. They will do whatever they can to help you. My brothers and sisters will care for them just as I would help theirs, because we are a family. I've imagined being a member of New York Fire Department running into one of the Twin Towers that fateful day. I would have surely fallen just as they did, side by side, doing the job. Members of the crews would have frantically dug to rescue me, just as they did for their fallen comrades, because we are a family. While I feel sorrow, I also feel pride that even a tragedy of this magnitude cannot displace. Pride for the strength and courage firefighters show every day. At fires and medical calls, at accidents and hazmats, they do their job. September 11th, my brothers and sisters in New York answered their last call. They did not run away. They did their job, and I am proud, because we are a family. How do I feel? As we struggle to come to terms with the enormous tragedy of September 11th, I grieve, not for the loss of a friend or a neighbor, but for the loss to the nation and to my family, the loss of my fellow firefighters. I did not know them, but I grieve still, because we are a family. With A Perspective, I'm Rich Collins.
It didn't last, that feeling of family. Families are complicated things, hard work. They squabble and compete. They come together and drift, or fall, apart. It happened to the American family, too, and it didn't take long. One culprit is undeniable. Fear. Fear is a basic and necessary human instinct. It keeps us alive. But it's powerful and dangerous. It can lie to us, make us see things that aren't there. To this day, we can debate who is responsible and why, whether fear was necessary or inevitable or manufactured. Either way, it was at the heart of our 9/11 story. The Reverend Dr. Matthew Lawrence is an Episcopal priest in Santa Rosa. Father Matt knows about fear. As a child, he knew where and what it was. Then, on September 11th, he saw it again. He saw the monster in the basement.
When I was a child growing up in Minnesota, there was a monster living in our basement. It was behind the furnace. It was ugly and fast, and it would eat your face off. That's what my older brother told me, anyway. So I learned to never, ever go into the basement at night. Of course, as I got older, I forgot about that monster until the planes hit the World Trade Center. I was living in Ann Arbor then, working as a chaplain at the University of Michigan. The man on the TV said we were under attack, and all of a sudden I was that kid again, believing in monsters. When that first tower went down, I went stupid with shock and found myself wondering, where did it go? Into the basement, came the answer, where the monster lives. In the clouds of dust and ash, I thought I saw it, rising and gorged, spitting poison. That night, a massive crowd of students gathered on the campus. As one of the chaplains, I was asked to say a few words. At the foot of the stage, some muscular boys were waving an American flag and chanting slogans of violence. The rest of the crowd was more subdued, some in clusters, some alone, some weeping, most of us confused and afraid. In the darkness beyond the crowd, I thought I saw the monster waiting. Somehow the Catholics had gotten hold of 10,000 candles which were passed around and lit. When it was my turn to say something, I hesitated. What words made sense? And then I felt the monster's breath on my back, and so I stepped forward and raised my candle in the air. Immediately, each one of those 10,000 candles rose into the night. It looked like a tentative, delicate galaxy of hope being born. It was as if the angel of mercy had appeared, telling us to not be afraid. The next time I looked into the darkness, the monster was gone. With a perspective, I'm the Reverend Matthew Lawrence.
But the monster was not gone. Candles did not make fear go away. Fear can make perfect sense. Don't step in front of the bus, the stove will burn you. It somehow made sense to the people, themselves full of fear, who had attacked us. But fear can make us stupid, and it can make us hate, and the point of terror, after all, is to terrorize, in the expectation that we will do to ourselves what others cannot do to us. And so it was. Peter Fehrenbach experienced it almost immediately after 9/11. As director of a prominent California peace organization, he was surprised to find some of that fear directed not at murderous criminals, but at him.
On September 11th, I sat on the coffee table and wept. My children were scared to see their father crying, and I felt deeply inadequate in my efforts to reassure them. As a native New Yorker, I see the city as the ultimate symbol of inclusion, with people of every faith, culture, and class thrown together in one big soup of doing your best to make it in this world. I adored the New York subway for its rough and tumble equality. Like everyone, the moment arrived when I needed to take a deep breath and head to work. But in my case, I needed to put aside my own feelings and formulate an organizational response. I was the director of California's largest peace organization, and I worked there alongside my wife. Though it was still early in the day, we arrived to a steady stream of hate mail and death threats. It went on from there. The hate mail continued. A bomb threat was phoned in. We suspended our canvassing operation because of fear that our staff members would be exposed to the risk of serious violence. While we sorted out the organizational questions, I've never resolved the personal ones. I have no idea how I would have explained to my children that some other Americans saw their parents as in league with mass murderers. I don't understand it myself. With my kids already upset by the attacks, I couldn't scare them with the reality that their parents were being threatened. I worried that if something did happen to us, they might not understand why we kept going back to work. For several years, I never spoke of it. My experience with this backlash was brief, and it was infinitely easier than experienced by Muslim, South Asian, and Arab Americans who in the past decade have faced suspicion, bullying, hate crimes, and discrimination. I make no pretense that any of this is even remotely equivalent to the suffering of those families whose loved ones were murdered. My own thoughts will be with them on this anniversary, as they were on 9/11. But something else died that day. While much has been made of Americans pulling together in the face of the tragedy, at the same time, we turned on each other as well. And that is something we still need to put behind us. With The Perspective, I'm Peter Fehrenbach.
It is a fact that the 9/11 terrorists espoused a particular brand of a particular religion. It is a fact that their skins were dark and they had a common place of origin. And it is a fact that being a dark-skinned person from that place and believing in that faith does not make you one of them. But not everybody believed that. They still don't. This wouldn't be America's first experience with the perils of color and identity. We have a long record of trial and error on that score. And while it's fair to say a redeeming virtue of America is a willingness to overcome, the aftermath of 9/11 is evidence we will always have more to overcome. Fear is a persistent monster. Jaya Padmanabhan is a South Bay writer. She's also a native Indian, and her skin is dark. That was all she discovered after 9/11 for many people to fear her by finding religion in her face.
As stories of courage and survival rose over the dust of the twin collapse, I began my journey of color and identity. For weeks later, I would devour the newspapers for names of the dead. It was a compulsion that had its roots in the fear that my outward appearance closely matched that of the villains in the tragedy. If there were enough dark-eyed, brown-skinned victims dead, would I see any lessening of suspicion on that stranger's face? Often enough, I was glad that I was not a Muslim. There were occasions when I would have liked to say that out loud, just to clarify, but it seemed unethical to do so. When news reports broke of turbaned Indian Sikhs being mistakenly attacked, spat upon, and even killed on occasion, it seemed to reinforce that fear and mistrust. This, then, was part of the terrorists' devious strategy, for beyond bringing down a New York landmark and killing hundreds of people, the legacy of fear, hate, and suspicion that they left behind was like an invisible, poisonous gas, easily consumed and capable of destruction and annihilation. Our features rarely reflect our religion. Our beliefs are seldom inscripted on our faces. What is plain is the underlying intolerance we bring to our beliefs. Thus, when I looked at the faces of the terrorists lined up on the television screen, I could see nothing but disrespect. I am Indian American, with dark eyes, black hair, and brown skin. Maybe more Indian than American, but in September 2001, I fell in love with my American. Though at some point we have to strip our definitions and emerge as humans capable of good, the Americans who died that day belonged to every religion. Accounts of hope and horror were not sorted by ethnic type and neither by skin color. The people who were victimized on 9/11, while outrunning their routine lives, were heroes of every denomination, and fittingly, their stories outlasted those of the perpetrators. With a perspective, I'm Jaya Padmanabhan.
The thing about clichés is that usually there's an element of truth in them. And the cliché that we're bound by what we have in common more than divided by what we don't is no exception. Listeners who submitted material for this program often made this point, that while 9/11 terrorized, it also deepened appreciation of the extraordinary ordinaries of life common to us all. Family and friends, music and nature and love, life itself. These things endure even when we are distracted. Shortly after 9/11, Les Block was in the parking lot of a construction supply store. He's a Danville stonemason and a project manager, so it was an ordinary place for him to be. What happened next was a small thing, but it brought two strangers together for a moment that didn't seem small at all.
The Home Depot parking lot is not the most popular place for an epiphany, but a week after the 9/11 tragedy, it came to me there, in brilliant orange and blue. We Californians were far from the horror, but we felt it in our hearts. We were connected, for the first time in our lives, by something both savage and mystical. I was picking up a couple of 2x4s and had them over my shoulder on my way back to the truck when I saw a man standing in front of his pickup, his hands planted firmly in his pockets. By the look of him, he worked with those hands, someone who wasn't afraid of a hammer or a dent in the tailgate. He was rugged, grizzled with a day or two of growth on his face. He was big. I'd seen him, or someone like him, 1,000 times over my years of construction, but I hadn't noticed him as we headed our separate ways. The man was taking it all in, looking west toward the sky. It was a quiet evening. The nation was still stunned. As I loaded my lumber into the truck bed, he turned to me. "It's a beautiful sunset, isn't it?" I looked across the parking lot and saw a Siena crescent, the light glowing upwards to a low blanket of clouds that stretched across a vibrant, endless blue. "Yeah, it is," I said. Our eyes met, and his mouth turned up just slightly, both of us sharing something that meant more than anything had in a long time. He shifted on his feet, then moved to the door of the truck and drove away. I stared at the sky a few more seconds, smelling a mix of Doug fir and exhaust, wondering what had happened to the world. I sat in the cab, listening to the sound of nothing. Things change, the world shifts, and people, what they value and cherish and take for granted, change as well. And when the dust finally settles, and we start to feel safe again, things change back. With a perspective, I'm less Block.
Most people think of history as an agreed set of facts, a fixed story told and retold. But history never sits still. Agreements become disagreements, new facts overshadow old facts. A different narrative emerges. 10 years later is embryonic history, so the story of 9/11 is still being written. Jesse Hempel described our moment between a decade ago, and we are still in a kind of historical moment between, wrestling with choices that will write the story to come. That's what Jolie Cannett, a Marin County business manager, thought about when she considered how to remember 9/11.
We mark the study of our history by war, by attacks, instead of marking war as an interruption of history. We have to take care not to mix the deserved commemoration of 3,000 people who died on September 11th with the remembrance of a failure of sanity. That's hard to do. It is so widely agreed upon to commemorate this day that any suggestion otherwise would seem beyond unpatriotic. But really, at the heart of it is a terrible sadness. Can we honor the goodness of those we lost without giving gravitas to their murderers? I would have preferred not to have this day as an annual reminder, and, as odd as it may sound, I'm not convinced we should. Maybe the greatest defeat we could offer those who manufactured the attacks would be to give them nothing. Not our anger, not our national attention, maybe not even our retaliation. Just turn away. Obviously, this is not what has happened, but it is possible to change what we do about it and what we think about it. We could call September 11th a National Day of Recognition. Recognition not of terror, but of what is good, what is right. Recognition that retaliation and anger is not the only response, as it was with the killers, and does not have to be with us. Recognition that religion is a sacred right, not to be confused with religious interpretation leading to acts of villainy, as it was with the killers, but does not have to be with us. Recognition that stereotyping on any side paves the way for blind enmity and war, as it did with the killers, but does not have to be so with us. Recognition that taking on the color of the enemy is the opposite of victory on any side. Just as the terrorist bombs bursting in air did not lead to peace, neither will ours. Let's commemorate September 11th by breaking the chain, by recognizing and stopping real evil in isolated individuals, not in nations or religions, and by recognizing and remembering the real goodness in most of us, everywhere. With a perspective, I'm Jolie Cannett.
Thanks to all our contributors to this program, Amanda Anaiti, Adam Bardi, Jesse Hempel, Rich Collins, Matt Lawrence, Peter Fehrenbach, Jaya Padmanabhan, Les Block, and Jolie Cannett, and to each KQED listener who submitted perspectives to this project. It was a privilege to read them all. You can go to kqed.org/perspectives to access a special page devoted to the 9/11 Project. You can listen to any part of this program, all the 9/11 pieces aired throughout the week, and of course, post your thoughts and comments. We'd love to hear from you. You've been listening to Remembering 9/11, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Mark Troutwine. Thanks for listening.
Local underwriting is provided by Leaf, Cabraser, Hyman, and Bernstein, with offices nationwide, including San Francisco and New York. Leaf Cabraser represents plaintiffs in personal injury, defective products, consumer, and employment cases on the internet at lchb.com.